Sophomore year, I got involved in the divestment campaign. It had started as something of a lark, I suppose, part of the radical pose my friends and I sought to maintain, a subconscious end run around issues closer to home. But as the months passed, and I found myself drawn into a larger role, I noticed that people had begun to listen to my opinions. It was a discovery that made me hungry for words. Not words to hide behind, but words that could carry a message, support an idea. When we started planning the rally for the trustees meeting, and somebody suggested that I open the thing, I quickly agreed. I figured I was ready, and could reach people where it counted. I thought my voice wouldn't fail me. The agenda had been carefully arranged beforehand. I was only supposed to make a few opening remarks, in the middle of which a couple of white students would come on stage dressed in their paramilitary uniforms to drag me away. A bit of street theater, a way to dramatize the situation for activists in South Africa. I knew the score, I had helped plan the script. Only when I sat down to prepare a few notes for what I might say, something had happened. In my mind, it somehow became more than just a 2-minute speech, more than a way to prove my political orthodoxy. I started to remember my father's visit to Miss Hefty's class, the power of my father's words to transform. If I could just find the right words, I had thought to myself. With the right words, everything could change. South Africa, the lives of ghetto kids just a few miles away, my own tenuous place in the world. I was still in that trance-like state when I mounted the stage. For I don't know how long, I just stood there, the sun in my eyes, the crowd of a few hundred restless after lunch. A couple of students were throwing a frisbee on the lawn. Others were standing off to the side, ready to break off to the library at any moment. Without waiting for a cue, I stepped up to the microphone. "There's a struggle going on," I said. My voice barely carried beyond the first few rows. A few people looked up, and I waited for the crowd to quiet. "I say there's a struggle going on." The frisbee players stopped. "It's happening an ocean away, but it's a struggle that touches each and every one of us, whether we know it or not, whether we want it or not. A struggle that demands we choose sides, not between black and white, not between rich and poor. No, it's a harder choice than that. It's a choice between dignity and servitude, between fairness and injustice, between commitment and indifference, a choice between right and wrong." I stopped. The crowd was quiet now, watching me. Somebody started to clap. "Go on with it, Barack," somebody else shouted. "Tell it like it is." Then the others started in, clapping, cheering, and I knew I had them, that the connection had been made. I took hold of the mic, ready to plunge on, when I felt someone's hands grabbing me from behind. It was just as we had planned it, Andy and Jonathan looking grim-faced behind their dark glasses. They started yanking me off the stage, and I was supposed to act like I was trying to break free, except a part of me wasn't acting. I really wanted to stay up there, to hear my voice bouncing off the crowd and returning back to me in applause. I had so much left to say. My friendships with Regina, and others like her, would lead me to re-examine the choices I made. "Look at yourself before you pass judgment," they would tell me. "Don't make someone else clean up your mess," they would say. "It's not about you," I'd be reminded. They were simple points, homilies I had heard 1,000 times before, in all their variations, from TV sitcoms and philosophy books, from my grandparents and from my mother. I had stopped listening at a certain point, I now realized, so wrapped up had I been in my own perceived injuries, so eager was I to escape the imagined traps that white authority had set for me. To that white world, I had been willing to cede the values of my childhood, as if those values were somehow irreversibly soiled by the endless falsehoods that white spoke about black. Except now I was hearing the same thing from black people I respected, people with more excuses for bitterness than I might ever claim for myself. "Who told you that being honest was a white thing?" they asked me. "Who sold you this bill of goods that your situation exempted you from being thoughtful, or diligent, or kind? Or that morality had a color? You've lost your way, brother. Your ideas about yourself, about who you are and who you might become, have grown stunted and narrow and small." I came to realize that while my identity might begin with the fact of my race, it couldn't end there. At least that's what I would choose to believe.